Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. There are a lot of disgruntled and disappointed delegates who've been heading home today from the UN Climate Summit, or COP29, in Azerbaijan. Climate change is the defining issue of our time, and the world is on course to experience its hottest year on record. Developing countries, which are suffering disproportionately from the growing number of extreme weather events, had hoped for large sums of money from rich countries, historically the biggest emitters of the greenhouse gas emissions. Under a framework UN agreement, those wealthy countries are obliged to contribute to climate finance to help less developed countries tackle the consequences of global warming. That figure was $100 billion a year. And although it was up to $300 billion in Baku, it's been widely criticised for failing to meet the scale of the challenge. Isitu Kumara is highly critical. She's Director for Climate Finance for the Gambian government and was the lead negotiator on climate finance for the group of least developed countries at COP29.
The goal that was adopted is really not ambitious, and it is not aligned to our needs, because the mandate of in establishing a new goal was for it to be aligned to the needs of developing countries. And the needs of developing countries currently, as we speak, it's over $5 trillion. That's what's needed by 2030. So if we have to extrapolate that, that means basically what's needed for us to respond to the climate crisis, it's basically $1.3 trillion per year. So that's what we were calling for. So you can just imagine from $1.3 trillion per year to $300 billion per year. That's basically, it was really shocking to most of us. And it was just like a slap to the face. So most of us were just disappointed.
But do you acknowledge that developed nations at the moment have financial concerns of their own, that it is conceivable that they might not be able to afford what you are asking for?
That has been one of the justifications that developed countries have been saying all along since we started the work program to establish this new goal. But for us, honestly, we don't think that's true. We think they have the resources, because the $1.3 trillion we are asking for, it's 1.4% of global GDP. And currently, all of us have seen what developed countries had spent on COVID when it hit the globe, the world, as I would say. And presently, we've also noted that developed countries are spending 1.7% of global GDP on wars. So that's why for us, we were really saddened yesterday with the outcome.
That was Isitu Kumara, Director for Climate Finance for the Gambian government. So why weren't rich countries at the UN Climate Summit able to come up with more money than they did to help poorer countries manage the disproportionate damage they've suffered as a result of global warming? I've been speaking to Eamon Ryan, the Irish Environment Minister, who had just landed back in Dublin after the summit. He's from the Green Party, currently part of Ireland's coalition government. What's his view on the agreement that's been reached?
Well, I think it was an important agreement. Relief was the first sentiment, because had it not been agreed, I think then the Paris Climate Agreement, which is our only real best structure to deal with the climate challenge that we all face, I think it would have been in real jeopardy. We all agreed that there has to be a fundamental shift in the entire financial system, not just this element, which is the public finance that supports going to developing countries. There is a clear injustice in the current system. Developing countries, other than China particularly, are not seeing the investment in the new clean renewable alternative that we all can have access to. And they also have not seen sufficient finance for what's called climate adaptation, so that they can prepare and protect against the climate change that's already coming. So we all agreed that there is a requirement for a fundamental change. The $300 billion is important. It is a critical element of that solution to that problem, but it isn't the only one. And the text we agreed last night actually was for a much larger $1.3 trillion figure, yeah, which will be made up of a variety of different financing sources.
I mean, that's the ambition, isn't it? $1.3 trillion. dollars. But I was just wondering, is Ireland even in a position to afford the $300 billion a year?
Well, we'll have to do, Ireland will make a contribution as part of the European Union. We have doubled the amount of climate finance we provide in the last 5 years. And Ireland tends to very much focus on the poor and most or lower income, most vulnerable countries. And we don't do it as loans, or we're not tied to any other interest. It's typically grant funded. So, yes, we will play our part. And it's in all our interests that we do this. In my mind, if we can see every part of the world making the leap to what is a better, cleaner, more secure economy, which reduces the amount of conflict, reduces the amount of forced migration, gives us better trade rules. There is everything to gain for us in providing climate finance, particularly for the developing world. So, yes, we will play our part. It was important in the negotiations, and Europe and the United Kingdom and others stood up for this point, that there does need to be a broadening, what they call a broadening of the base of those who do contribute to the public finance for the most vulnerable countries. And again, the agreement from there yesterday or last night was very significant, because it's not changing the characteristic of, take a country like China. It's not saying suddenly, oh, now you're a developed, wealthy country. They are still a developing country. But it is counting, first of all, a lot of the existing financial flows between the likes of China and other countries in the global south, but also allowing other countries make voluntary contributions as part of this overall approach. But also countries like Saudi Arabia, which would have huge revenues, huge wealth from the use of fossil fuels. It's important that countries like that also make their contribution, and it's not just framed in a West versus the rest or global North-South.
Do you see a problem selling this to Irish taxpayers? I mean, they're going to be footing part of the bill, aren't they?
No, I think we have always had a tradition, for a variety of cultural reasons going right back, of wanting to play our part in development, particularly in the global south and the likes of Africa and elsewhere. So no. One of the elements of the deal is that it involves as well a lot of investment from the likes of the World Bank, the European Investment Bank, the IMF. And a lot of it won't come directly from the Exchequer. It will also come from changes to the financial rules of those organisations. And that's equally important, but it isn't always calling from the Exchequer to make the contribution.
That was Eamon Ryan, Ireland's Environment Minister, speaking to us from Dublin. With the amounts of money being discussed at COP29 are beyond the comprehension of most people. $100 billion a year, $300 billion, $1.3 trillion. But what about the size of the summit itself? 65,000 delegates registered to attend. But do such gatherings need to be so big? And could that very size be an impediment to reaching agreement? I'm joined now by Richard Black, who is at the COP29 summit. He's Director of Policy and Strategy at the Global Clean Energy Think Tank, EMBER. And Richard, you would have heard there two opposing views about the outcome of the COP29 summit. What's your takeaway?
I think the main takeaway is that the finance deal got done. And I think both of the speakers that you had on both had points that are absolutely genuine. On the one hand, the sum of money that's been promised here is a long way below the various estimates of what's needed to do two key things, really. One is to help the developing world to green their economies. And the other thing is to protect them against the climate impacts that are already seeing around the world. On the other hand, there is plenty of scope left to scale up the finance, as Eamon Ryan was saying, from the $300 billion that's been agreed per year to the $1.3 trillion per year. That's the commonly accepted figure now of what's actually needed. And so a lot of that needs to happen outside the UN Climate Convention. So I think, the main takeaway was that the deal got done.
There were thousands of delegates at this particular COP. I mean, apart from their enormous carbon footprint in getting there and then getting home, how many of these attendees actually have any kind of impact on the final decisions?
Yeah, it's a very good question. If you were to really, really look down at the sort of final minutes of the negotiation and what actually, you know, who actually is in the room, it would be a relatively few people because countries assemble themselves into blocks. And so you have the European Union, obviously, which generally tends to side with New Zealand and Australia and Canada and the US, not always, but generally. And then you have the small island developing states and you have the African bloc and so on. And then you have a few big countries that, you know, plow their own furrow, such as the United States, China, India. So you could probably say there's probably about 7 or 8 points of view that are very, very firmly represented. But of course, every other country has had a say in what those blocks' positions are. And of course, a lot of delegates and who go there aren't really concerned with the negotiations. They're concerned with discussions on other things. So you will see, for example, the International Solar Alliance is there, the international group that exists to promote solar power. And they may be meeting with government ministers or bureaucrats or maybe solar farm developers. And so a lot of these discussions that happen are not directly connected with negotiations, okay, but they are nevertheless very relevant to the overall process of protecting against climate impacts and delivering the green economy.
But could the attendees be stripped down and conclusions reached perhaps more effectively?
Well, the number of attendees absolutely could be stripped down, and they've really grown a lot in recent years. I mean, one of the COPs that lingers longest in my mind is Copenhagen, which was a really important one back in 2009. 45,000 delegates were registered. Just over half of that number could actually get in the conference center. So that was a lot more important, but it was a lot smaller. If you stripped away all of the people who are not directly connected with negotiations, I don't think, however, that it would make negotiations go faster, because, as I said, a lot of the people that go aren't really there to get involved in the negotiations at all.
COP30 will take place next year in Brazil, but also under a very different president in the United States. What kind of a difference is it expected that that'll make?
Well, the advent of Donald Trump 2.0 is, of course, going to affect a lot of the way that these things go on. I think the biggest thing that will be felt at global level is the absence of US diplomacy in encouraging other countries to make progress. So it's not like the US itself has been a major contributor, for example, to climate finance. It just hasn't been over the past year, even though logically it ought to be. Sorry, over the past years, even though logically it ought to be. It's that diplomatic push, I think. We saw that, for example, President Milei of Argentina was emboldened by the Trump election to withdraw his delegation from the talks. They actually, you know, they're going to stay in the Paris Agreement. Yeah. That's one thing that will happen. But the most important country in the global clean energy transition is not the US, it's China.
Okay.
And I think it's to China we must look.
Richard, many thanks for that. That was Richard Black, a Director of Policy and Strategy at the global energy think tank Ember. Coming up, we remember the South African writer and anti-apartheid activist Breton Breitenbach, who's died aged 85.
I think it's a great loss. I think he is one of Afrikaans' most iconic writers. And I think he's been a very important spokesperson for justice in South Africa. And he also suffered personally when he was imprisoned.
The latest headlines from the BBC newsroom. The authorities in the United Arab Emirates say they've arrested 3 suspects in connection with the killing of an Israeli Moldovan rabbi, which has angered Israel. An exit poll from the first round of Romania's presidential election suggests that the Social Democrat Prime Minister has a clear lead. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. The authorities in the United Arab Emirates have arrested 3 suspects in connection with the killing of a rabbi who went missing last Thursday. The body of Rabbi Ziv Kogan, who was a joint Israeli-Moldovan national, was found earlier today. Israelis have been able to work and live in the UAE since the signing of the Abraham Peace Accords in 2022. Earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu pledged to bring the rabbi's killers to justice. I've been speaking to the BBC's Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. Firstly, are there any details about how Rabbi Kugan met his death?
He only went missing on Thursday. 24 hours later, there was an announcement that terrorism was suspected, that he had gone missing, and there were real concerns that Mossad, Israel's external spy agency, was looking into this and was taking charge of the investigation together with the Emirati authorities. And a few hours after that came the announcement that his body had been found and his car was found about 90 minutes drive away from his home in Abu Dhabi. I mean, quite a bit is known about him. He's a young rabbi, 28 years old. He was part of something called Chabad, which is a worldwide organization that helps that caters to the social, humanitarian and religious needs of Jews around the world. But it's very much an ultra-Orthodox religious organization. So he was a missionary, as it were, a Jewish missionary in the Emirates. And the suspicion in Israeli circles, government circles, is that this was an attempt by Iran to try and drive a wedge between Israel and the Arab countries that it's made peace with. Obviously, the peace that Israel has made with those countries is somewhat strained because of the wars it's conducting in Gaza and Lebanon and the very high death toll in both countries.
Had the rabbi relocated from Moldova or from Israel?
Well, he's a joint Israeli-Moldovan citizen. So my understanding is that he had pretty much established himself in the UAE, where he was managing a kosher supermarket. The reaction here from Israeli government and the president is really pretty vitriolic. They're calling this an anti-Semitic attack. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said that we're working closely with the Emirati authorities in the UAE and that we will continue to develop those ties and work even closer with them, and that we will not let anybody sort of drive us asunder, as it were. But only a couple of weeks ago, I was at the Arab Islamic Summit in Riyadh in Saudi Arabia. There was really I wouldn't say exactly consensus, but certainly a strong feeling there amongst Arab and Muslim countries of condemnation of Israel's actions in Gaza, the very high death toll, the displacement of most of Gaza's 2.5 million population. It's placing enormous strain on those Arab governments.
In the shorter term, though, Frank, is it likely to make Israelis less willing to visit the United Arab Emirates and indeed to do business there?
Yes, I think it is. The Israeli government have raised the sort of threat level to what's called level 3, which is the third highest out of 4, and warning against all but necessary travel to the UAE, which is a step backwards, because when the Abraham Accords first happened, there was a huge influx of Israeli tourism, particularly to Dubai, and there was a lot of technological transfer. There's a security accord between the two countries in terms of surveillance technology and things like that, a lot of defense cooperation. But you're not hearing so much about that now, and certainly this, I think, will send a chill through ordinary Israelis looking to travel to the Gulf.
That was the BBC's Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. And since we recorded that interview, Iran has rejected allegations that it was any way involved in the murder of the rabbi. The deaths of 6 tourists from suspected methanol poisoning in the Lao town of Vang Vieng is continuing to send shockwaves along the popular backpacking trail in Southeast Asia. The Lao government has now confirmed that an American victim was found dead in his hostel bedroom on the morning of November the 13th. In addition, the 2 young Danish women who died were found unconscious in their room on the same day and rushed to hospital. Our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield-Hayes has been to Vang Vieng to meet tourists, from where he sent this report.
It's late afternoon and the Nam Song River in Vang Vieng is bustling with watercraft of every description.
I'm out here in the middle of the river that runs through Vang Vieng, and around me there are speedboats, kayaks, people in big inner tubes floating down the river. To my right are beautiful, stunning cast limestone mountains. And in the sky above, hot air balloons. You can really get a sense of why so many young travellers love to come here. It's an incredibly beautiful place. There is a lot to do, and there are very few rules.
Vang Vieng is now firmly on the Southeast Asia backpacker trail. Each year, hundreds of thousands of travellers pass through here, heading south into Thailand or north towards China. On November the 12th, Britain's Simone White and 19-year-old Australians Holly Bowles and Bianca Jones were all staying at the popular Nana Hostel, known for its party atmosphere. Their deaths, along with three others from methanol poisoning, has sent a shockwave through the backpacking scene here. At a breakfast cafe, I met two young women from the United Kingdom who'd just arrived from Vietnam.
We were scared at the beginning that it was spiking because we thought it was concerning that it was all these women which were having like the worst effects from it. I think people are concerned because there's just no real answers, I think. So everyone's just like on edge.
You've done quite a lot of travelling around Southeast Asia. So, I mean, presumably you've drunk in other places as well, and this shot culture exists in Southeast Asia.
Oh, yeah. In Vietnam, you know, you get free drinks, particularly if you're playing games in the evening, and we've just never thought about it. You just presume that what they're giving you is safe. So, like, we've had free shots, we've had buckets before, but moving on, we're just not going to take the risk
at all.
It's not. It's definitely not worth it.
The Lao authorities have now confirmed that one of the victims, a 57-year-old American man, was found dead in his bedroom at the Nana Hostel on November the 13th. On the same day, two young Danish women were found unconscious in their room and rushed to hospital. As night falls, the sound turns from splashing water to pumping music. It's peak tourist season here. The hostels are full. The bars should be too.
This is a weekend night in peak tourist season, and you get a real sense here of just how much these poisonings or news of them is hurting business here, because so many of the places I've walked past here tonight are pretty empty. And we also understand police have told bars that they have to close at midnight instead of going on to how they used to be, 3 a.m.
Jack is a 21-year-old from Somerset in the UK, out on the backpacker trail with his friend Ned. Despite what's happened, they say they don't feel unsafe here.
It seems like everyone's still here having a good time, but there's definitely like a mood in the air that people are being a lot more cautious. And there's everyone's all saying the same thing, which is, you know, don't drink the spirits out of the bottles, you know. We're sticking to bottled beer, you know. It's a safer option.
I would like to add that Lao, I've been here for like a week now. The people here are absolutely lovely. They are some of the nicest people I've spoken to. There's never a purpose of them out to get you.
Nevertheless, six people died here, and parents with children out on Southeast Asia's backpacker trail are now frantically messaging them, telling them not to come to Vang Vieng.
That report from our Asia correspondent Rupert Wingfield Hayes in Lao. You're listening to NewsHour, coming to you live from the BBC World Service in London. Do stay with us, a lot more to come. This week in the US state of Georgia, Jose Ibarra was found guilty by a judge of the murder of 22-year-old Lakin Riley. Ibarra, a 26-year-old migrant from Venezuela, had entered the US illegally. The case became a flashpoint in the bitter row over immigration throughout the presidential campaign. From Washington, D.C., the BBC's Rebecca Hartman reports.
Count one. Malice murder, I sentence you to life without the possibility.
In a courtroom in Athens, Georgia, Jose Ibarra was sentenced to life in prison for killing Lakin Riley, a nursing student, while she was out jogging at the University of Georgia.
Court documents detailing the disturbing allegations against the illegal immigrant charged with killing Lakin Riley.
It's a case that has garnered nationwide attention with hours of coverage on cable news networks, in particular Fox News. The murder happened just weeks before the State of the Union address, a high-profile speech the president gives to Congress and the nation on key policy issues. As President Biden walked onto the floor, he was met by Republican Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. She's a representative from Georgia who's on the right wing of the party. She's standing there on the Senate floor wearing a T-shirt emblazoned with the words, "Say her name." Something she urges the president to do as she hands him a badge with Lakin Riley's name on it. She later heckles him during his speech.
Winner. I
Lincoln Riley, an innocent young woman who was killed by an illegal. That's right.
Republicans laid the blame for Riley's death at President Biden's door. This is Alabama Senator Katie Britt delivering the Republican reply to the address.
We know that President Biden didn't just create this border crisis. He invited it. Just think about Lincoln Riley. In my neighbor.
Throughout the campaign for the White House and at the Republican National Convention, Riley's murder was repeatedly held up as an example of perceived failings of President Biden's border policy.
Tonight, America, this is my vow. I will not let these killers and criminals into our country.
All right, we just heard from the judge in the Lincoln Riley trial. His decision that Jose
After the verdict
Ibarra
in Georgia was read out, there was wall-to-wall cable news network coverage spanning the political spectrum. Away from the courtroom, Donald Trump wrote on social media, "Justice for Lincoln Riley. It's time to secure our border and remove these criminals and thugs from our country." It's a familiar rallying cry from the campaign trail that, when he takes office next year, his supporters will be expecting him to carry out.
That report from Rebecca Hartman in Washington, D.C. You're listening to NewsHour. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. A minister of the British government is warning that Russia is stepping up its cyber warfare against NATO. Pat McFadden will say in a speech in London tomorrow that hackers are disrupting everything from aid supplies in Ukraine to critical infrastructure across the alliance. Emily Taylor is an associate fellow at the Chatham House think tank here in London, where she focuses on cybersecurity. I asked her what she made of Mr. McFadden's comments.
It's interesting that and intriguing that he's using the term cyber war, because generally cyber activities are below the threshold. They're in a sort of grey zone where it's annoying, it can be disruptive, intimidating, it can lead to disinformation and divisiveness. But to elevate it to the level of war is a very striking choice of words.
So you object to the use of war, but you do acknowledge that Russia is, for instance, capable, as Mr. McFadden suggests, of plunging the UK into darkness.
Russia is a very active and capable adversary in cyberspace. The usual techniques one would associate with Russia are influence, disinformation, the sort of cognitive type of warfare, trying to spread division in societies. Russia is extremely effective at that. And also espionage. So it has the capability to penetrate systems, and it has shown that many, many times. But it tends to use its positioning in critical infrastructure or other equivalent systems to acquire information, maybe to do hack and leak, maybe a little bit of temporary disruption. So that is what we've seen to date. I would interpret these remarks as very much in the context of fear of escalation in the Ukraine conflict and uncertainty about the position of the incoming US administration.
How would you, though, categorize an attack on the UK's national grid? You wouldn't categorise that as cyber warfare.
It would all depend on what that attack is and what the effect of that attack is. Russian and other adversaries are constantly attempting to gain positions within their own adversaries' systems. But it's what they do with it that matters. What we've seen in the past from Russian activities, you know, particularly in the Ukraine, we've seen power outages as far ago as 2015, 2016, power outages caused by Russian cyber attacks. They had gained a position, waited months, and then switched the lights off at the same time. When the Ukraine invasion started in 2022, a lot of commentators were expecting much more of a cyber element on the battlefield. But what quickly transpired was actually the use of very traditional methods to harm critical infrastructure in Ukraine, and the use of cyber more for spreading disinformation with the occasional malware distribution and that sort of thing. So to date, cyber has been used for psychological purposes and espionage mainly, not for that real destructive type of purpose that Pat McFadden is warning about.
I mean, in much the same way as Russia is being accused of cyber warfare, is it reasonable to expect that NATO and Western governments are doing similarly with Russia?
Well, the cyber domain, the sort of grey zone, which sits somewhere under the threshold for armed conflict, is used by many states for traditional espionage, but also for disruption, particularly at this moment where the tensions in the Ukraine conflict are heightened because of the use of long-range missiles, that cyber is a natural area for everybody to be thinking about, both from a defence point of view and their own vulnerabilities, because it allows that long arm, it allows an adversary to reach into your country without having to move their troops onto the ground.
That was Emily Taylor, an Associate Fellow in Cyber Security at the Chatham House think tank in London. A British businessman caught on camera confessing to illegally selling millions of dollars of luxury perfume to Russia is not facing criminal charges, the BBC has learned. David Crisp was arrested last year, but his case was later dropped by HM Revenue and Customs, the tax-collecting agency, which is also responsible for enforcing sanctions. Selling luxury goods to Russia is a serious offence, punishable by up to 10 years in prison under the sanctions imposed on Russia after its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. But campaigners say the US is far behind other countries when it comes to punishing violators. Our correspondent Will Vernon reports.
I'm from London.
Oh, no kidding.
I live in Dubai.
British businessman David Crisp doesn't know he's being secretly recorded by an undercover investigator. He's about to confess to violating sanctions against Russia.
How's your Russian organ?
Don't tell anyone.
It's doing really well. Oh, good for you.
We ignore government edicts.
Right.
Government edicts is a reference to the sanctions. Mr. Crisp thought the man he was speaking to was a potential client interested in buying his £1,000 a bottle perfume.
It speaks for itself, really, doesn't it?
Yeah. Watching the video with me in central London, his former business partner, David Garofalo. He brought in investigators after a whistleblower came forward.
He'd actually gone out of his way to disguise the fact that he'd continued selling to Russia by doctoring the management accounts. He had deceived our in-house lawyer and misled our auditors.
The BBC got access to both the undercover video and account documents, which showed that Mr. Crisp appeared to try to cover up sales to Russia. The evidence was accepted by a judge in a civil case brought by Mr. Garofalo. In a provisional ruling, Crisp was removed from the management of the company.
Do you know how much the total sales amount was?
It's approximately 1.7 million. In goods that are dispatched from us, obviously, in the retail market, that would be considerably more.
Once he had full control of the company, Mr. Garofalo immediately ceased trading with Russia. He also contacted the HMRC, the government agency that enforces trade sanctions in the UK. They opened an investigation into Mr. Crisp.
By the time we approached HMRC, it was an open and shut case. We had all of the documentary proof. They were disinterested, and a few months went by and we learnt that, stunningly, HMRC had dropped the case.
The government has brought in more than 50 rounds of UK sanctions against Russia since the full-scale war began. But in that time, the BBC understands there hasn't been a single criminal conviction for breaching trade sanctions. The government told the BBC they've implemented sanctions on Russia, which are the most severe ever imposed on a major economy, and they say they are fining companies for violations. But they didn't tell us why they dropped the investigation into David Crisp, as they don't comment on individual cases. In a statement, David Crisp told us that he strongly refutes the allegations made against him by Mr. Garofalo, and that at no point did he knowingly trade in breach of Russian sanctions, nor attempt to conceal those trades.
Will Vernon reporting. Breton Breitenbach, who's died aged 85, was a celebrated South African anti-apartheid activist, writer, poet and painter. He mostly wrote in his native Afrikaans language, and although he won a number of international awards, his work was not widely read outside the country. But his opposition to apartheid made him a thorn in the flesh of the government of his fellow Afrikaners. He lived much of his life in exile in France, but on a secret trip to South Africa, was arrested and sentenced to serve 7 years in jail on treason charges. Hein Willemse retired in 2022 as head of the Department of Afrikaans at the University of Pretoria. His thoughts on the parting of Breton Breitenbach.
I think it's a great loss. I think he is one of Afrikaans' most iconic writers. And I think he's been a very important spokesperson for justice and against injustice in South Africa. And he played a major role as a public intellectual in this country. And he also suffered personally when he was imprisoned. So in that sense, it's a great writer that has passed. And I think that in Afrikaans literature especially, he would be remembered for the richness that he brought to his writing, the incisiveness of his public criticism in his essays, and generally just for the person that he was.
Why did he risk returning to South Africa, a secret trip back in 75, which led to him spending 7 years in jail?
I think it was in fact 9 years. What happened was that, you know, Breton Breitenbach was one of the younger generation of writers, and he had contact with people who were anti-apartheid in South Africa at that time, around the 1960s, late 1950s, early 1960s. And generally, they were a very small grouping of people who were anti-apartheid, white South Africans who were anti-apartheid. And then he later on met, he went overseas, went to Europe, to France, and met a Vietnamese woman who became his wife later on. And obviously that kind of relationship was banned in South Africa simply because of the apartheid system. And I think that turned him against the political powers of the time. And also he felt himself a personal relationship to insurgent bodies like the ANC, the African National Congress, and others. And, you know, there are various stories around how that process happened and how he got involved with this resistance organization. Some of it seemed to me, simply afterwards a bit naive. But afterwards, he was obviously came to South Africa in 1975, and he was followed right from the get-go. And he was caught very soon into his quote-unquote project. And then sentenced. It was, I think, the idealism of a young man asking, how could I contribute to changing the country?
I mean, do you have a favourite poem of Breton Breitenbach? And perhaps you could tell us why.
I've got several of them, but I like mostly the older ones, the ones that he wrote about his family, the poems he wrote about the country, his expression of the world in which he lived and grew up. And that kind of evocation of the land and of the cultural environment. And later on, his political poetry, that probably in Afrikaans was directly, probably the most outspoken writer, I think, that spoke directly to oppression, spoke directly to change and so forth. And that in itself, and the kind of language that he used was very rich in terms in Afrikaans literature. That's extremely evocative in terms of imagery, very rich. And in terms of language use, versatile. And that's the kind of writing that I think captured most of his readers, the kind of richness of language, I would say.
Thoughts on the passing of Breton Breitenbach, who's died aged 85. A reminder of our top story this hour. Poor countries say the billions of dollars pledged at the UN Climate Summit in Baku go nowhere near addressing the challenges they face. Speaking to this programme, Richard Black of the global clean energy think tank Ember told us many are looking ahead to what the new occupant of the White House will mean for climate change.
The advent of Donald Trump 2.0 is, of course, going to affect a lot of the way that these things go on. I think the biggest thing that will be felt at global level is the absence of US diplomacy in encouraging other countries to make progress.
And the top story from the BBC News, from the former Colombian president who signed a landmark peace deal with FARC rebels exactly 8 years ago, has criticised successive governments for failing to fully implement it.